if you take a multinational from a place that has good constructive relationship with its employees and with the union in that country, do they bring those practices with them, or do they adopt the local practices?
To call the April 19th vote to unionize by Volkswagen AG workers in Tennessee historic might be a bit of an understatement. Not only was it the first foreign-owned auto plant in the South to organize, the vote was a mind-blowing 2,628 to 985, or 73% in favor. The astounding win by the United Auto Workers came after decades of losses as plant after plant opened across the South. On today's show, Dr. Stephen Sylvia explains how foreign automotive companies, whose workers had strong unions in their home countries, followed an American playbook to stifle organizing efforts in the United States. Sylvia is a professor in the School of International Service at American University and author of The UAW's Southern Gamble: Organizing Workers at Foreign-Owned Vehicle Plants. He talked with Dan Galadner on the Tales from the Reuther Library podcast. We've got a link to the entire interview in the show notes. And on Labor History in Two.
The year was 1971. That was the day the Occupational Safety and Health Act went into effect.
I'm Chris Garlock, and this is Labor History Today.
Welcome to Tales from the Reuther Library, a podcast beaming out of the Walter P. Reuther Library from the campus of Wayne State University in the heart of Detroit, Michigan. I am Dan Galadner, your host, and with me is the star of the show, of course, is Troy Eller English. I just made her giggle.
Yes, you did.
How are you feeling today?
I've felt better.
You felt better, exactly.
Everyone is sick right now. All the people. But there is sun outside, and we haven't seen that for quite a while in Michigan.
That is true. It is nice to see the sun in Michigan, and I hear, again, we're going to get 50 degrees soon, so by the time you listen to this podcast, it'll be probably freezing again.
Probably.
Yeah, that's the way it goes. But anyway, on today's podcast, believe it or not, is a perfect timing podcast. We rarely are on top of current events on this podcast, but this time we are. We are talking about the UAW and organizing foreign-owned plants in the southern United States. After their groundbreaking strike and win last year, the UAW immediately stated that they were venturing south once again. And soon after, they informed the press that 30% of workers at the Mercedes-Benz plant in Alabama had signed authorization cards. So, what better timing on this show than to talk with Stephen Sylvia and about his book that came out last year called The UAW's Southern Gamble, Organizing Workers at Foreign-Owned Vehicle Plants. Dr. Sylvia, who received his PhD from Yale University, is professor at American University's School of International Service, where he teaches international economics, international trade relations, and comparative politics. This is his first deep dive look at the UAW's organizing drives in the foreign vehicle plants in the American South, starting in 1989 and ending in 2019. He deconstructs the organizing drives at Daimler Chrysler, Mercedes-Benz, Nissan, and Volkswagen over those years, showing us the mistakes that the UAW had committed but advanced as they tried to figure out how to organize these plants. Every step they took, they got better and better, and learning from their mistakes, but always falling short in these victories. See, at the same time the UAW was learning, so was management. He points out in his book that the companies had their own playbook to avoid unionization, and they shared these techniques with each other. There were larger factors that would blindside the UAW or that the UAW ignored. Now, that the UAW is back down in the South to organize workers, they must remember that the fight is on three fronts. And this is pointed out in the book. There's the work site, which has mandatory meetings, special associations that are set up by workers to fight the UAW, and TV sets in the break rooms, constantly barraging the workers with anti-union messaging. And then there are the boardrooms in the U.S. and overseas, and of course the political environment, which we know is not very union-friendly. All three of these factors Sylvia talks about and opens the door for us to peek in to see how it all operates. So I would encourage anyone who is following what the UAW is doing in the foreign-owned plants in the southern United States, as well as what other unions will be doing down south, Pick up this book, The UAW's Southern Gamble by Stephen Sylvia. Like me, you will learn more about what was happening than you originally actually thought. Steve, thank you so much for joining Tales from the Reuther Library podcast. We really enjoy having you here today.
Well, thanks for asking me. I really appreciate it.
You mentioned this playbook. There's a union avoidance playbook, and I never heard the term before. I always knew they are companies and they had ways of being anti-union, but there was actually what you call a playbook. What is that exactly?
Yeah, you know, the playbook is something that's evolved beginning in the 1980s. Some of the pieces were always there for a long time, like doing captive audience meetings and one-on-one meetings if a unionization drive was happening. But the additions to the playbook and something that has really come together is a playbook really began in the early 1980s. And I would say the father of the playbook would be a former Ford executive who was the first CEO of the Nissan Smyrna plant, Myron Runyon. And he's the one who really developed this thing that evolved into a pretty standard playbook that all of the companies use. And there's carrot and there's propaganda in this playbook. And so some of the things that that evolved were, first of all, placing the plant in a rural location. And the rural location had the advantages of workers who didn't have experience with unions or whose family members didn't have experience with unions on the most part. And it also scattered the workforce that a lot of these plants, people drive 100 miles to work in the plant from all around. So it's kind of hard to have a union meeting when you've got a 200-mile radius to deal with. Mm-hmm. Hiring was something that was taken very seriously in a way of looking for people who would be unlikely to join a union. And it's funny, some of the things that they'd look at people who played high school sports, why they thought that, who knows, you know, some of these things are just what they did, whether they really are true, who knows, you know, yeah. Military folks, they'd look for firstborn people. So really bizarre, really intrusive things, but this is what they did. They really tried to screen people. And certainly if somebody had a union job previously, they wouldn't hire the person. And the thing that would be the case when you do this hiring in rural areas, for every job you'd get, you know, 10 applicants, so you had a big pool to pick from. A third piece of this playbook would be this one team approach, this idea. We're all one big team. I think this goes with hiring the people who participated in high school sports as well. And the implicit thing in it is, well, the union is not part of that team, you know, regardless of the fact that the union is the representative of the workers and you know, a union is the workers. They would sort of describe the union as the outside party in this. They certainly wouldn't describe the anti-union consultants that they hired as an outside party, but that's, you know, the way these things go. A fourth element, which has become very important in all these plants and also in the domestic plants, is having a two-tiered labor force. In the tiers would be a permanent labor force and temporaries that are hired from a temporary agency. And the permanent labor force, they would, depending on the plant, they would get good pay, good benefits, would not get laid off if things got bad. But this temporary labor force, which would be coming from a temp agency, they're the ones who would take all the swings in the economy, and they would lose their jobs. They'd get paid less. They'd have lower benefits. So this really, and you know, this really made it difficult for organizing, because the temporary workers, they're working for a temporary agency, so they would not be in the bargaining unit. And the temporary workers would aspire to become permanent employees. And the companies would say, yes, you know, you, if you work hard enough, we will convert you into a permanent employee. And they'd convert a couple, but most of them they wouldn't. Mm-hmm. And but it kept that group not wanting to rock the boat at all, and wanting to, you know, really show that they deserve to be promoted. So it really divided the workforce. One more thing that I think was very important, and that is that starting in that Nissan plant in Smyrna, they put monitors everywhere in the plant, in the break rooms, anywhere where an employee would be. And these TV monitors would play pro-company, anti-union messages constantly. They'd also play anti-Big Three messages. If something went wrong in Detroit, they would play that. And so they constantly got bombarded with this, you know, with this propaganda at the workplace. So this all came together, and companies learned from one another, particularly through union avoidance law firms, to the point where today this is a very standardized set of tactics that the law firms have managed to spread and that are unrolled whenever a new plant is set up.
That partly it sounds like your description is that they read labor history, right?
Yes.
Stood the ideas of going to the community, which the UAW did with organizing Ford in the 40s, heavily into the church, all these things, but a little touch of modernism, you know, with this, these monitors everywhere, the brainwashing, the constant feeling that you are part of one team, and this is why, because Detroit's bad, and this is bad. That's amazing how they put that together. And it kind of like segues into my next question is like, all right, we talked about the assembly plants in North Carolina, the vehicle plants, the truck plants. They organize relatively well, easily. All organizing is difficult. It's not an easy job to do, but fairly okay. But then the playbook started happening. Why don't you give us an example of what happened at Mercedes-Benz to give us more like insight of, wow, this, the playbook is working. Mercedes-Benz, that organizing drive, what happened? How to fall apart?
Yeah. So I'll start a little bit with Freightliner first, right after Daimler bought them, because that's a very early case. And that's an instructive one, because Freightliner had been organized on the West Coast by the machinists. And Freightliner management, right before Daimler bought them, set up a parallel production site in North Carolina. And that was the site that the UAW successfully organized, first one plant, and then a decade later, they picked up three more. And the thing that's interesting is a contrast about that case is the union avoidance playbook wasn't nearly as evolved. And Freightliner management wasn't nearly as determined to shut out the union, because they already had a union. They did resist the union, to be sure, in North Carolina, in the first plant in Mount Holly. But things that you see today that you didn't see then, one, Freightliner didn't receive any subsidies to build this plant. And as a result, the local government didn't feel vested and didn't get engaged. And that changes radically as you get the plants later. And so the local community didn't get involved. And the company really didn't do this one team approach. They really didn't do this screening and hiring. They didn't do a lot of the things. They also didn't give, you know, obviously you're not going to be getting a cut rate rental on a truck. So they didn't do that sort of thing either. And, the, you know, conditions can be volatile in this truck sector, that the sales go up and down. And so people wanted job security. And so that led, that was a spark for that first organizing drive. And then the three subsequent plants show a couple of things. One, international union cooperation can make a difference. And you see that both with the initial organizing drive at Mount Holly and then the one that comes 10 years later, that when the UAW was trying to organize that Mount Holly plant, one of the things they did is they had a couple of UAW reps fly to Germany and they talked to the president of the Metal Workers Union. They talked to the head of the Daimler Works Council, and the head of the Daimler Works Council went into a meeting where the UAW reps were present talking to Daimler management, and this legendary German works councillor, Karl Feuerstein, said to management, "I hear you're giving them trouble in North Carolina. If you hire permanent replacements, you're going to have trouble with us in Germany. And you won't just have trouble in North Carolina." And so you had him intervene and really make a case for the UAW, to help out the UAW. And then the later three plants, at that point, it was during the period when Daimler Chrysler existed. And Germany has this system of co-determination that has employees on the company board. And because Daimler owned Freightliner, the decision was made to allow a UAW representative to be on Daimler's board. And that representative, Nate Gooden, reached an agreement with the Freightliner management to allow for neutrality and card check recognition. And so that's how things unfolded, by and large. There was one exception where an anti-union group challenged card check in one plant, but the UAW was so confident that they were going to win it that they said, okay, we'll run a full election. And they did, and then they won that plant as well. So that cooperation really made a difference, that transnational cooperation, and the fact that you did not have the union avoidance playbook really being used by Freightliner. Now, Mercedes is a completely different story. Mercedes is a greenfield plant, and it was done, you know, during the time of Daimler Chrysler. And you would have thought that Daimler, being used to working with the UAW, would have had no problem.
Right.
But they decided that they were going to keep the UAW out, that this was when Dieter Zetsche was the head of Daimler. And they had had some tense negotiations with the UAW regarding the big three. So they made the decision that they were going to keep them out. And one of the things that they did is they paid higher wages in the UAW contract for the permanent employees, not for the temporary ones, but for the permanent ones. And they got the cut rate car rentals, and no one would ever get laid off at that plant. And so it made it very hard to organize at that Daimler plant. But that's the only one of these transplants that pays the UAW contract rate. The other ones don't.
You're listening to Dr. Stephen Sylvia on Labor History Today. Dr. Sylvia is a professor in the School of International Service at American University and author of The UAW Southern Gamble, Organizing Workers at Foreign-Owned Vehicle Plants. He talked with Dan Galadner on Tales from the Reuther Library.
You know, question you asked earlier that I didn't answer is the UAW and how the UAW approach things. And, you know, I think the UAW was very serious about this. And at various stages along the line, the UAW did innovate and did try to take a strategic approach. There was an instance where the UAW even hired some consultants to come in and advise them on how to organize the transplants after they had a difficult loss in the Nissan Smyrna plant. But then, you know, the consultants, after they listened to what the consultants had to say, and you had some focus groups done of employees in non-union plants, that the UAW leadership decided that they knew what to do to organize and backed off on what the consultants said. I think the UAW leadership, you can see that they had one of the things that was found in the focus groups is that instead of what the UAW leadership thought would be the case, and that is that the workers in those plants thought that they would be see themselves as second tier employees, that they actually saw themselves as an elite on the cutting edge compared to the big three, and were proud of working for these transplants. So it was really hard to find a leverage point often as an endpoint in some of these plants to get them to organize. And when you look at some of these drives that you saw innovation, the UAW was one of the first unions to use mobile phones widely and to use websites. So there certainly was innovation in one of the last campaigns that I look at, and that was the Nissan plant in Canton, Mississippi. There was a very elaborate and successful civil rights-based theme that the UAW used, but they really couldn't break through in the plant itself. So they ended up, they weren't successful there. So you do see, on the one hand, innovation. Very interesting innovation on the part of the UAW. The one thing that I would say, though, is that you don't have a real comprehensive strategy that you could call a counter playbook, that they never really put that together, even though they knew that these things would happen. Mm-hmm. That, for example, for all these drives, the second a drive would start, there would out of nowhere be an employee anti-union group that would suddenly form with very murky funding sources. And you knew that this was going to happen, but there was never really strategic thinking about how to address that. You knew the politicians in the South were going to get involved. But there never has been a strategic plan on how to address that. Now, I'm hopeful. Since the book came out, I've had conversations with the new head of organizing at the UAW, Brian Shepard, who comes out of the Service Employees International Union. And the conversations that I've had with him, that he's very aware, coming out of the service employees, of the need to have this strategic counter playbook. And it's something that they're working on now, but it's something that they didn't have before. And I think it has been costly that they didn't have it.
Right, right. And I think that's why sometimes through the narrative, the general public thinks, or even some sort of union people think, that the UAW weren't prepared for the Southern organizing that was going on. But all along, they knew it was going on, but sometimes the playbook wasn't matching what they should be doing. That's what you're trying to say, and that's what I gathered from it too. Exactly. Yeah.
And it was reactive. So they do innovative things that were reactive, but the thing that they didn't really step back and say, we know this is what we're going to face. We know we're going to face these groups popping up of supposed employee anti-union groups. We know that there's going to be political opposition, and really having a comprehensive plan on how to deal with this.
Right, exactly. So what is going to be the big takeaway from your book, The UAW's Southern Gamble, when someone reads
this? I'd say there are a few takeaways. One of the things that drew me into this to begin with, is the question of, if you take a multinational from a place that has good constructive relationship with its employees and with the union in that country, do they bring those practices with them, or do they adopt the local practices? And one thing that's very clear in the book is that they adopt that the companies, you know, for the Japanese, you know, Nissan, they have a very paternalistic relationship with their unions, and they brought a paternalistic relationship without the UAW with them. But with the German ones, they have a very good social partnership relationship. Did they bring it with them? No. And even at first, Volkswagen tried, but then through a succession of some accidental things, some intentional things, by the time you got to the third representation election in with Volkswagen, you couldn't tell Volkswagen from a Japanese transplant apart. So the answer is no to that. You know, another question that I had in mind in the book is, there have been a lot of people who've been talking about reforming labor law. And reforming labor law has been on the agenda for the labor movement for over a decade, you know, since Obama was elected, and even before, when you had the Choice Act. And then, you know, in the last 10 years, you've had the PRO Act. And there have been people like at Harvard University, there's this clean slate project on, if you wrote labor law from scratch, what should it look like? And I have to confess, I'm increasingly of the view that you can't form labor law, that that taking a legalistic approach, the employers are always going to be able to out-lawyer you, and that it makes the workers passive and reactive, that they end up waiting for, you know, NLRB rulings. And it really, you know, is sort of like an opioid for militancy, waiting for the law. Mm-hmm. And so it's something that, in looking at it, so I began, it's part of when I was thinking about Volkswagen, you know, the first election that Volkswagen had, 47% of the employees voted in favor of the union after a brutal anti-union campaign by the Tennessee politicians. You go to the third recognition election at Volkswagen, 48% of the employees voted for the union after Volkswagen used the anti-union playbook. And I kept on thinking, if the Flint sit-down strike had happened under today's laws and with the union avoidance playbook, would Flint have ever been organized? And I don't think they would have. You know, mm-hmm. I don't think we know if there was a majority of people in the Flint plant after an anti-union campaign would have voted for the UAW. And so that led me to think, we have to think beyond labor law. And we have to think, go back before 1935. And so this actually, I'm just beginning my next book. And my next book is reading reading before 1935 and looking at what people were doing and how unions were organized, reading, you know, what Sam Gompers was talking about, reading what John L. Lewis was talking about, reading people like William Z. Foster, communist, and what they were doing. And I'd say in particular, though, reading what A. Philip Randolph and what African Americans were doing. Because if any group of people were under the most oppressive system working against them to try to organize, it was African Americans trying to organize. Mm-hmm. So to figure out how to organize successfully without the law in the way, that I'm looking at, you know, these cases is coming up with a new, just new thinking on saying, if we really want to recapture the labor movement, we have to get to that, those days of spontaneity, and look at their tactics and revisit those tactics is a way to revitalize the labor movement.
That is going to be a fascinating book. And I can't wait to read that one as well from you. Always our follow-up question, our last question is, because it's from the Reuther Library, we'd love to know which collections you used here to help you with your research. But also, did you use other archives as well? So first, what are the great collections here that you used?
Well, the great collection that I used was the UAW collection. And Gavin Strassel there was extremely helpful. He really was wonderful. When I was doing this, he had just been the person who became in charge of the UAW collection. And the thing that was interesting is that the union presidencies up to Owen Bieber had been very well processed and cataloged, and there was a very good structure for finding things. But the UAW presidents after Owen Bieber, that it was just raw stuff that, with limited budgets and everything, haven't been processed. Gavin told me that in the interim, he's gotten to do Jokic, and that he's working on Ron Gettelfinger, who's the next one. But the things that I was working through was just boxes that were the boxes that came straight from the UAW. But Gavin was great. You know, he was, let me do it and let me go through the stuff raw. And I really appreciated that because I found all sorts of interesting things. Like there's one thing where I talk about sticky notes on different things between, you know, Owen Bieber and his chief deputy. And so it was very good. And I was, of course, very careful to make sure that I didn't, you know, upset anything. And I found some interesting things as well. You know, people donating old UAW badges and sashes. And I found this great letter from Joe Biden. It was around like 2010 or so. And it was a thank you note for being made an honorary member of the UAW. And it, like, you could tell Joe Biden must have, you know, dictated this thing, because at the end, the last sentence in the letter is, "You guys are great, man." So it was really funny. And so, you know, it was a lot of fun. And, you know, it's a great room there. And the Reuther Library, you know, the conditions are great. And so that's where I focused. And because I was looking at the UAW, that's really the only archives that I used. Some of the stuff on the German side, I got access to some of their raw files and things. But they're a bit behind in their archive, and because they keep their own archive that they, you know, it's a different system in Germany. So you don't have things going to universities. So the Reuther archive was the one that I used primarily for the book. And I've used other archives for other projects. But, you know, I'd have to say that I really, you know, you guys are great. You know,
excellent. That's what we like to hear. That's what we like to keeping our researchers happy. They keep writing the books, make us happy as well. Steve, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it. This has been a wonderful experience, and I can't wait to share this interview with other people. I know other labor podcasters and radio shows are dying to read your book and interview you as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Really awesome. Enjoyed it.
Tales from the Reuther Library is a production of the Walter P. Reuther Library and Archives of Labor and Urban Affairs at Wayne State University, coming to you from the heart of the Cultural Center of Detroit, Michigan. The producers are Dan Galadner and Troy Eller English. The music was composed by Bart Bilmer. And of course, this podcast could not be done without the research and the support of the entire Reuther Library staff. For more information, please visit our website at www.reuther.wayne.edu. Thanks for listening. Say goodbye, Dan.
Goodbye, Dan.
I'm Rick Smith. And this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1971. That was the day the Occupational Safety and Health Act went into effect. At the time, it was estimated that 14,000 workers died annually on the job, 2.2 million workers were permanently or temporarily disabled, and 500,000 developed occupational diseases each year. It was estimated that at least 25 million serious injuries and deaths went unreported each year. Many of the standards, regulations, and enforcements OSHA now has have come as a result of intense, continuous pressure waged by the labor movement. The Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union was the first to test out the new bill when they filed a complaint against the Allied Chemical Company in Moundsville, West Virginia, in May of 1971. Among the many hazards at the facility, pools of mercury on the shop floor were common occurrences. OSHA issued its first citation against Allied Chemical under the General Duty Clause. The first OSHA standard issued came a year later for asbestos. Today, the AFL-CIO notes that for the year 2015, 4,836 workers were killed on the job. There is only one OSHA inspector for every 76,000 workers, and on average, it would take OSHA 145 years to inspect every workplace in the country. But new rules protecting workers from silica dust and beryllium have been established, as have strong reporting and record-keeping standards. There are stricter coal dust standards and anti-retaliation protections for workplace whistleblowers. The Trump administration is currently looking to overturn all of it. You can take action this Workers' Memorial Day to protect working conditions on the job by finding an event in your area by going to aflcio.org. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
That's it for this week's edition of Labor History Today. You can subscribe to LHT on your favorite podcast app. Even better, if you like what you hear, sure hope you do. Like it in your podcast app, pass it along, and leave a review. That really helps folks to find the show. Labor History in 2 is a partnership between the Illinois Labor History Society and Rick Smith Show, a labor-themed radio show out of Pennsylvania. Special thanks this week to Dan Galadner and Troy Eller English and the always excellent Tales from the Reuther Library podcast. Check it out wherever you get your podcasts. Labor History Today is produced by the Labor Heritage Foundation and the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. You can keep up with all the latest labor arts news. Subscribe to the Labor Heritage Foundation's weekly newsletter at laborheritage.org. The Labor History Today team includes Ben Blake, Patrick Dixon, Leon Fink, Sherry Lincoln, Joe McCartan, Evan Papp, Jessica Pozak, and Alan Weirdak. For Labor History Today, this has been Chris Garlock. Thanks for listening. Keep making history, and see you next time.